Hello, Marco Werman here. With so much going on, it can be difficult to take a moment to pause and reflect on gratitude. We are so grateful for everyone who makes this show possible. The engineers behind the scenes, the reporters and correspondents on the ground, the editors reviewing and researching our stories, the producers making connections, finding guests, and ensuring that everything runs smoothly. And of course, you. Your support is critical. Thank you. Because of your financial support, we can run our newsroom and share with you the latest international human-centered reporting. So I'm asking for your help. From now through December 31st, we aim to raise $67,000. You can step up and donate to keep the world going strong. And to magnify the impact of your gift, a generous donor has created a match to double your contribution. If you give $100, the world will receive $200. Please head to theworld.org/give. Or visit the link in our episode notes and donate today. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for being with the world. Now, on to the show.
The Biden administration wants a pause in the fighting to get more humanitarian aid into Gaza. For longer-term peace, this expert says the two sides need to get back to a peace process.
Israelis and Palestinians have a proximity problem. Separation through negotiations is the only, in my judgment, viable path.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Brazil, the government mobilizes the military to go after the drug trade.
So it's a big problem, and it's directly related to the same gangs that promote violence in the urban areas.
And in Russia, environmental activists are standing up to the authorities. This woman says locals are getting cancer, and pollution from a nearby landfill is to blame. All these stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. Antony Blinken was back in Israel today. The Secretary of State met with senior Israeli officials and urged them to look at implementing a humanitarian pause in Gaza. Blinken said that would help speed up the effort to get badly needed aid into the Palestinian territory after nearly 4 weeks of Israeli airstrikes. Blinken spoke about the atrocities committed by Hamas in Israel on October 7th and how troubled he's felt watching Palestinian children being pulled out of the rubble in news coverage. Speaking with reporters in Tel Aviv today, Blinken said that Hamas must not be allowed to remain in control of the Gaza Strip and that there's only one longer-term solution for this conflict.
The best path, maybe even the only path, as I said, is through two states for two peoples. Again, that is the only way to ensure lasting security for a Jewish and democratic Israel, the only way to ensure that Palestinians achieve their legitimate aspirations for a state of their own.
But now, with Israeli troops reportedly encircling Gaza City and more than 10,000 Palestinians and Israelis killed, how viable is the two-state solution? Aaron David Miller spent his career working on this as an advisor to six U.S. secretaries of state. I want to get to the two-state solution in just a moment, but first, the violence in Gaza. When Blinken talks about a humanitarian pause, is that just another way to say ceasefire?
No. In fact, I think the Americans have drawn a pretty bright red line to divide the two. Humanitarian pauses for a number of hours in order to facilitate humanitarian aid going into Gaza and perhaps the release of hostages going out is a far cry from a negotiated ceasefire that could bring hostilities between Hamas and Israel to an end.
There's been concern that Hezbollah in Lebanon might join this war against Israel. The group's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, gave a highly anticipated speech today. Here's a little of what he said through an interpreter as broadcast on Al Jazeera.
The United States is totally responsible for the war raging in Gaza against unarmed, defenseless people.
He also criticized the U.S. for supporting Israel and said that all options are on the table. How much do you worry with your expertise about this war expanding?
I worry a lot. An escalation in the Northern Front, which would mean heavy Israeli airstrikes and even a ground campaign in southern Lebanon, and Hezbollah's use of their 150,000 to 200,000 high-trajectory weapons would be a dramatic escalation. It might, since we have two carrier strike groups in the Eastern Mediterranean with 200 strike aircraft, mean bringing the United States in, and it could, although I'm not predicting this, lead to a direct confrontation between Israel and Iran, which would almost certainly, invariably, bring America in.
On to the two-state solution. There have been no serious negotiations in the peace process since 2014. Many observers have seen the two-state solution as no longer an option for years now. What is Blinken suggesting here when he raises that today?
Any future, post-Hamas future in Gaza, post-conflict future in Gaza, will have to be tethered to a two-state solution, because I do not believe you can get Palestinian, legitimate Palestinian participation in any effort to deal with governance in Gaza if you do not address the problem of two states, which is the least bad solution, I would argue. Israelis and Palestinians have a proximity problem. Separation through negotiations is the only, in my judgment, viable path. You cannot house these rival nationalist movements, a non-state actor who wants to become a state, and the state of Israel, under one happy roof where everybody lives happily ever after.
So Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in recent years, you know, has not supported the peace process or a two-state solution. He was not standing alongside Secretary of State Antony Blinken when he was speaking to reporters in Tel Aviv today. What do you think Blinken is hearing from the Israeli side about reviving the peace process?
Talk to us later, is what I think they're hearing. This prime minister's future is extremely uncertain. He presides over the most extreme right-wing government in the history of the state of Israel, having presided over the most severe terror attack in the history of the state, bloodiest day for Jews since the end of the Nazi Holocaust. The average length of an Israeli government since independence is 1.8 years. This government comes to its one-year term in December. There's going to have to be a political reckoning in Israel. If you want to talk seriously about a two-state solution, you're not going to be able to do it with this Israeli government, and you're not going to be able to do it with this Israeli prime minister.
So given that, what influence, if any, does the U.S. have right now with Israel?
The U.S. has a lot of influence. It always has with the Israelis. The question is, presidents have been reluctant for any number of reasons to use that influence. Would it ever bring this president to make a phone call to this Israeli prime minister with respect to the ground campaign and basically say enough is enough? It's an intriguing question. I doubt it. I think there are priorities right now, and the key priority right now to talk about and make credible the U.S. desire to see a two-state solution.
So given your long history of work in the State Department and all of this, how are you feeling watching the war today?
Distressed, humbled by the uncertainty of what we don't know. We know very little about the fate and state of the hostages. We know almost nothing about the negotiations to free them. We know very little about the ground campaign. I'm focused on the humanity of this conflict, the atrocities committed on October 7th, but that can't allow our hearts and minds to be closed and shut off from the devastation and destruction that's going on, the deaths of Palestinian innocents. I also think about hope and history. I was in Jerusalem on October 6, 1973, when Egypt and Syria launched the October War. I saw an Israeli society that was traumatized, and yet within 6 years of that trauma, Egypt and Israel signed a treaty of peace. 20 years later, I sat on the White House lawn watching Arafat, Rabin, and Clinton sign the Oslo Accords, convinced wrongly that Israeli-Palestinian peace was only a matter of time. In that case, hope turned to trauma. So trauma to hope, hope to trauma, we really can't see what's in front of us. And the arc of history bends in strange and unpredictable ways.
Aaron David Miller was an advisor to six U.S. Secretaries of State on Arab-Israeli negotiations. Aaron, thank you so much for your thoughtful analysis.
It was really great to be here with you.
Poland ranks as one of the worst countries in Europe for LGBTQ people. As recently as 2020, 100 Polish municipalities declared themselves free from what they called LGBT ideology. Last month's national election saw the ruling party pushed out of power, bringing hope to the gay community. Still, the road ahead might not be an easy one. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports.
3 years ago, Bart Staszewski traveled across Poland to towns that had passed declarations vowing to stamp out what they described as LGBT ideology. On the outskirts of each town, Staszewski, who's gay, hung a yellow sign that looks pretty much like your typical road sign, but it read LGBT Free Zone. Then he took a photo and uploaded it to social media. His posts quickly went viral, and they caught the attention of the Polish Prime Minister.
Suddenly became the national enemy by the Prime Minister, who was accusing me of lies, anti-Polish lies.
That's Staszewski speaking to PBS News in 2021. For 8 years, members of the Polish government have consistently used anti-LGBTQ rhetoric in their speeches. But on October 15th, the party's fortunes changed.
In the aftermath of the country's parliamentary election, it was the ruling Law and Justice Party that seemed to have gathered the most votes. But it was the opposition Liberal coalition that appears headed for a majority in parliament.
Staszewski tells me when he first heard those election results, it felt like he'd finally woken up from a bad dream.
For me, it's the nightmare that ended, because it'd be 8 years of being second category citizens, this LGBT free zones, this horrible language that became normal. We were the target of it. This is something that is ending.
The new coalition government has yet to take office. But Donald Tusk, who's expected to be the country's next prime minister, has already promised to introduce same-sex civil partnerships in Poland, which are popular among the majority of voters. Staszewski says before any of that, the new government needs to introduce a ban on homophobic hate speech. Otherwise, he says, the abuse that the LGBTQ community get will never stop.
It will be still a problem because we have a press, we have the politicians who will be telling that we are some kind of threat, pedophiles, going for the kids, horrible, horrible things that should never happen in the 21st century. But this is the reality we have.
Poland's main public broadcaster has been aligned with the outgoing populist government for the last 8 years. And Staszewski says anti-LGBTQ rhetoric on that TV channel hasn't stopped since October's elections. Last week, more than 100 schools in Poland celebrated Rainbow Friday.
Each year, the last Friday of October is the celebration of the visibility of queer community in schools.
Dominic Kutz is with Growspace, the organisation that runs the event. He says there was a big increase in the number of schools taking part this year. The main public broadcaster, though, ran with the headline, "Watch out, Rainbow Friday is coming. Parents, you can still protect your children." That headline might explain why so many students in Poland have told Kutz's organisation that they struggle to be open about their sexuality.
Only 26% trust that the school will help them in a situation of discrimination and violence. The saddest statistic is that over 70% of youth, queer youth in Poland, have at least once experienced suicidal thoughts.
This week, all schools in Gdańsk in northern Poland got a letter from the regional education department asking them if they had hosted the Rainbow Friday event and if they'd asked for parents' permission to do so. Kutz says it's a clear attempt to intimidate the schools and the students. Magda Dropek is with the Equality Foundation in Poland. She's hopeful things will change under the new coalition, but she says even if the incoming government passes new laws, like a same-sex marriage bill, for example, there's another obstacle.
Of course, we have to remember that there's still like a president who has the power to veto the bills.
The Polish president, Andrzej Duda, has previously said that LGBT ideology, as he calls it, is worse than communism, and he remains in power until 2025. Dropek says not everyone in the new coalition government has the best record for promoting LGBTQ rights either. And she says a new government doesn't necessarily mean a change in attitude from the various state bodies.
It's difficult to have a trust to, you know, the police, to politicians, to, you know, to ministries, to everything. Just everything was so politicized and also like used as a tool for the anti-organization. They need to like, you know, gain the trust again from the people.
Dropek says she knows lots of people in the LGBTQ community are still thinking about emigrating. Activist Bart Staszewski says he did consider leaving Poland a few years ago, but he was worried that his mother would be targeted instead if he continued his activism from abroad. He recalls Christmas Eve 2 years ago when the police called to their home.
The police called us that there was somebody pretending to be me, calling the police stations around the Poland, telling that they have a bomb there and that I killed my family. And they gave my name, you know, the police came to my home to check if my mother is alive.
Staszewski says his mother asked him that night if he really wanted to continue with his activism. But he says she understood it was something he feels he has to do. Maybe now, he says, with this new government coming into power, things might just get a little bit easier. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. In Brazil this week, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva deployed federal troops at major airports, seaports, and areas along its borders. This is the latest effort to interrupt the cocaine traffic that fuels organized crime in Latin America's largest country. Bruno Pantaleon knows the story well. He's a professor of international relations at Getulio Vargas Foundation. He joins us from Sao Paulo. Bruno, how big of a deployment is this?
Not very big. In the past, they have done similar deployments using military personnel in civilian settings, so on the streets, in favelas, in poor neighborhoods. This time, they're only deploying military to the borders and airports and ports, which are all federal jurisdiction already. So there's no imposition on the jurisdiction of the state and municipalities.
And what authority is he using to do this? Is it like a kind of martial law?
No, it's a few steps below martial law, but it's within the same constitutional chapter. It allows the president to assure law and order anywhere in the country under direct intervention and to take special steps to ensure it, either deploying the military or even intervening directly in the public security departments in the states.
So these troops are being deployed at airports, seaports, and border areas. Can you tell us how the cocaine trade works in Brazil and how those troops might be able to interrupt that?
So the cocaine trade is very large and very decentralized in Brazil. It's run by thousands of micro to large operations, and it pretty much relies on price arbitration. So it costs very little to buy cocaine in the Andes, but it's sold for a lot of money in the ports or airports. So you can, for example, buy some cocaine for $500 near the border of Paraguay or Bolivia and sell it for some $10,000 in the city of São Paulo. So there is a large incentive for criminals to get involved in the bulk trade of cocaine. So the deployment aims to both stop the cocaine from coming in through the borders. And these borders are very, very large. We're talking about thousands and thousands of kilometers of borders that are mostly uninhabited. Lots of it are rivers. Lots of it are forests. So it's very hard to contain drugs there. And then you have these drugs going out. They go out through the major ports disguised as chicken, as beef, as coffee, as sugar, as legal commodities. So it's a big problem, and it's directly related to the same gangs that promote violence in the urban areas.
So the cocaine is transported across borders from countries that are on Brazil's western side and then basically transported overland east to the coast, and that's where they can fetch a higher profit.
Yes, and then they are already very well connected to mafias in Africa, to mafias in Europe, and then they have this entire supply chain connections to make sure that it goes all the way to Europe and gets sold in retail for 70,000 euros. So it goes from $500 to 70,000 euros in just a few exchanges, going through just a few actors with different gangs cooperating internationally.
And so this massive organized crime network, I understand that it's about 3,600 to 3,700 military personnel being deployed. Is that likely to make much of a dent in that drug trade?
It's very unlikely. We can go at it for two perspectives. So in the airports and ports, I think the whole idea is to disrupt corruption schemes that may happen there and to introduce some new set of eyes. I don't see this as possibly being effective, and I don't see this as a good deployment of military resources.
Mm.
Now, the border, there is a good rationale to involve the Air Force and the Navy to watch the border because the borders are very porous.
Mm. Bruno Pantaleon is a professor of international relations at Getulo Vargas Foundation. He was briefing us on Brazil's problems with organized crime and the cocaine trade and its latest effort to control it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Caroline.
The country of Colombia has a big problem, hungry, hungry hippos. As many as 181 of them, to be exact. They're considered invasive there and have proven dangerous to people and other animals. But the Colombian government has a new plan. We're joined by Maria Angela Echeverri, professor of biology at Javeriana University. She joins us from Bogota in Colombia. We're going to get to the plan to deal with these hippos in just a moment. But first, Maria, there's a fascinating backstory to why they're in the country in the first place. Can you tell it?
Unfortunately, back in the 1980s, the drug lord Pablo Escobar imported to the country several animals, and some of them were brought from different collections or, you know, just from illegal trade, brought to Colombia to his private farm. And he got his private zoo going. Along some of those animals were four hippopotamus that came, one male and three females.
So have these hippos been causing problems?
They've been causing a lot of problems. So we have these huge hippos that are altering the whole ecosystems due to their size, due to their needs in terms of food and the amount of feces that they put up in the ecosystem. They're actually changing the geochemistry of the water. And that means they are altering completely the ecosystem. But on the other side, we have to think about the social problem that they're bringing on. This major river basin called the Magdalena area, it's known for its fishermen, and that's their main livelihood. But hippos are highly territorial, and that means that already in Colombia, in different towns close to the area where the hippos are concentrated right now, there have already been attacks for the population.
So the Colombian government has been wrestling with this for a long time, and they have a new plan to surgically sterilize some of these hippos, transfer others out of Colombia to different countries, and then possibly to cull or euthanize others. What do you think about this approach?
Back in April, the government of Colombia asked two major institutions to do a full report on what was the status of this population. In the report, they explicitly say that the sterilization is not recommended, mainly because it would not cut down the population growth at the speed that it would be needed to decrease some of the impacts that they are already putting through. However, yesterday we came up the news that the government was going to try to sterilize 20 individuals per year. And, you know, that's very confusing because basically, one, they are not following the recommendation of the report that they paid for. But the other problem is that the sterilization of these individuals is highly variable in terms of their effectiveness. So we might be investing somewhere around $204,000 per year for the sterilization of just 20 animals that we don't know if it's actually going to work.
And so do you have any sense of why the government might have taken that approach? I mean, are the hippos popular and they don't want to have to euthanize them?
In Colombia right now, there's a big push trying to identify that animals as individuals should not be managed. Right now, the government does not want to deal with the harsh, and to say the truth, it's hard to come up with a solution to just have to proceed with euthanasia for all of these animals. It's definitely a hard solution. But given the data that we have on the analysis that have been made, that's the one option that we see would be the most responsible one.
Maria Angela Echeverri is a professor of biology at Javeriana University. She joined us from Bogota in Colombia. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Caroline.
You're listening to The World. Climate scientists have an urgent message to convey to the public, but they're not always the perfect messengers. And that is where comedians come in.
You know, no one likes a lecture, ultimately, but, you know, if you're being told you're going to listen to a comedian, you might enjoy it.
A new pairing to fight climate change. That story's ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler, and this is The World, a co-production with GBH in Boston and PRX. Across the Middle East today, eyes were on Beirut. That's where the leader of the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah delivered a highly anticipated speech. It was his first public pronouncement since the deadly October 7th Hamas attack on Israel. Hassan Nasrallah, heard here through a translator as broadcast on Al Jazeera, praised the killings of that day.
This glorious, blessed, large-scale operation was 100% Palestinian in terms of decision and execution, 100% Palestinian.
Reporter Rebecca Collard watched that speech in a coffee shop in the Lebanese capital, and we have her on the line now. Rebecca, what were the headlines from that speech today? That was a striking quote.
Yeah, you know, first of all, let me say, thousands of people gathered in Beirut to watch the speech. But this speech was done by video link because for more than a decade, Hassan Nasrallah has almost never been seen in public. We don't actually know where he is. So, you know, when he gives these speeches, people gather to watch him essentially on a screen. But I think the first point that, the clip that we just heard, this is something that's been talked about a lot since October 7th. And at first, both the U.S. and the Israeli government said, you know, this was the work of Hezbollah and this was the work of Iran. But he's reiterating the fact that he had nothing to do with, and Hezbollah had nothing to do with this attack. What else he said was that, you know, all options are on the table. So he said everything is possible. He stressed again that Hezbollah was already engaged in the fighting. We've seen that fighting over the last more than 3 weeks now. And he also reiterated that, you know, here in Lebanon, Hezbollah calls the shots. Hezbollah will decide what sort of escalation it's going to do, and that is not coming from Iran. So here's another clip from his speech.
Since October 8th, the resistance in Lebanon is engaged in a true, genuine battle that can only be felt by those on the southern borderline. It is a true battle, different from all those in the past.
The Hezbollah leader Nasrallah also said that it has all options available. Is there a message he's trying to send to Washington at this moment?
Well, yeah, and I mean, let's remember that Anthony Blinken is in Tel Aviv today, talking to Israelis. So I think the message is also being sent much, much closer than Washington. You know, he also, Nasrallah, today blamed the U.S. for the war in Gaza. He called the U.S. the great Satan, and he said this.
The swift response by the United States to support and back Israel has proven how failing Israel is.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of rhetoric we've seen for the last 3 weeks. And I will also just say, Carolyn, you know, along with the rhetoric against the U.S. that we've seen from Iran, from Hezbollah, we've also seen this stepping up in attacks against U.S. targets across the region. So, of course, in Iraq, there's been several attacks against bases where there's U.S. forces. There's been this call from Iranian allied militia in Iraq to that the U.S. forces should leave. We've also seen this escalation in Syria where there's been, attacks on U.S. forces in Syria. So I think, one of the things that he is also trying to say is that, the U.S. is obviously implicated, he feels, in what's happening in Gaza. And, one more thing I'll say, as we were arriving today at this big venue where there were thousands of people watching, they were handing out Hezbollah headbands and also these cards with a bunch of chants on them. And a lot of them, of course, were against Israel. They were about solidarity with Gaza. But one of the chants also was death to America.
I know you were watching in one of Beirut's southern suburbs where Hezbollah is popular. What was the mood like there? You just touched on that a little bit.
We talked to people as they were arriving, and I kind of said, what are you expecting? And most people were just saying, we know that he's going to say the right thing. But it was also quite tense. Me and my colleague who I was with were actually detained by Hezbollah members. We were on the street trying to collect some sound and talk to people, and they detained us. It wasn't dangerous at all.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's really fine. It's not being detained by Hezbollah in one of the southern suburbs is usually something that goes fine. They're concerned about what we're doing there. They wanted to look what was on our phones. But in the end, you know, they gave us tea. We had to sit there for an hour and a half, but it was a pretty relaxed experience. A little bit obviously annoying when we were trying to find out what people were thinking about the speech. So in the end, the only people we really got to speak to were them. I asked them what they thought about the speech. And of course, they were very much supportive about what he said and were on the same page as Nasrallah.
The area that you're talking about, where you are now, Hezbollah has a lot of support there. What about the rest of the country?
Yeah, well, now I'm actually, back in kind of East Bay rooted, some more Christian neighborhood. And here there are no Hezbollah flags. There is no people chanting in support. I think people here were obviously still watching his speech because, you know, Carolyn, this for the last more than 3 weeks now, there has been a war looming over this country. Everybody is constantly talking about whether or not there will be a war here. And everybody knows that this decision, whether or not they're going to war, is not going to be made by Lebanese people. It's not going to be made by the Lebanese government. It's going to be made by Hezbollah and Israel. So, of course, everybody was watching the speech. But I think some people thought that today we would have a more definitive answer, and we didn't. And I think that, there was some talk on social media now outside of his traditional support base kind of saying, you know, what is this? Like, we've been waiting for weeks for you to speak and you know, you didn't really say anything definitive.
So Hassan Nasrallah is the Hezbollah leader. He has been in hiding for many years. So what is his significance? How important is he as a regional leader?
Yeah, I mean, I think that because Hezbollah is, you know, the strongest non-state military actor in the region and likely in the world, people in Yemen, people in Iraq, people really across the region, other militant groups that are allied with Iran, part of this, you know, axis of resistance, were also watching what he was saying today and likely to take cues from him. And of course, we've seen these attacks, as I was saying, in Iraq, in Syria, but also from Yemen a couple of days ago. And he mentioned these attacks directly, this barrage of rockets that were fired by the Houthi rebels toward Israel. A few days ago, he mentioned those directly. And so I think, of course, he is, you know, he's very significant regionally. But one of the things that he also stressed when he stressed that Hezbollah does not take orders from Iran, he also made it clear that every one of these militant groups and countries in this axis of resistance makes their own decisions. So they do act together. They have shared goals, but they make their own decisions. And I will say, Carolyn, you know, he is really known for his fiery speeches, his criticism of Israel. And I think that's another reason why everybody was waiting today for, you know, what he was going to say. And I will say it just seemed a little bit more damper. He did not seem to have that energy. The defiance was still there, but he didn't seem to have the same energy he normally has in his speeches.
Rebecca Khalid has been covering the regional reaction to the Israel-Hamas war from Lebanon. Thanks so much, Rebecca.
You're welcome.
In Ukraine, the city of Kherson found itself under attack yet again overnight. The frontline city was liberated from Russian occupation almost a year ago, and in recent weeks, it's been a frequent target of Russian drone and missile attacks. Yesterday, strikes set homes and public buildings on fire. Ukrainian authorities say Russia unleashed attacks across the country last night. President Volodymyr Zelensky posted a video from the northern city of Kharkiv. It showed buildings and cars ablaze as firefighters struggled to put them out. In his regular video message late yesterday, before those overnight strikes, Zelensky had a message for Ukrainian troops.
Пишаюся вами.
I'm proud of you guys, he said, and I'm sure that Ukraine will win. He said Ukraine's military forces are just as committed as they were on February 24th, 2022, when Russia's full-scale invasion began. Also yesterday, the White House addressed the question of future U.S. funding for Ukraine. The House passed a Republican plan to provide more than $14 billion in aid to Israel, but it did not include aid to Ukraine. Here's John Kirby from the National Security Council speaking to reporters.
President would veto an only Israel bill. I think that we've made that clear.
Meanwhile, today in Russia, President Vladimir Putin made a public appearance. Putin spoke with members of the Civic Chamber, a government consulting body, and referred to Russia's initial 2014 annexation of Crimea in Ukraine. He seemed to suggest that seizing the region would not have been necessary if only Ukraine had had brotherly feelings toward Russia. A group of Russian soldiers fighting in Ukraine recently shot a video making an urgent appeal directly to Putin.
а также президенту Российской Федерации обратить внимание, пока мы находимся в зоне СВО, проливаем нашу кровь.
The soldiers weren't complaining about conditions on the battlefront. They were asking Putin to close a landfill in southern Russia. Complaining like this to Russian authorities is dangerous. In the last year, Russia has jailed anti-war activists and shut down NGOs, including environmental organizations like the World Wildlife Fund and Greenpeace. But as Levi Bridges reports, many Russians are still finding ways to bring about change.
The landfill those soldiers were complaining to Putin about stands in a wide stretch of fields crisscrossed with irrigation canals. Locals say the landfill, which serves as a dumping ground for trash sent from many other towns, is literally killing people. Soil here has been found to have high levels of mercury and arsenic. Earlier this year, protesters blocked the road to the landfill and called for its closure. Pretty soon, a long traffic jam forms before them. Then the cops show up. A bystander filmed a video that shows police wrestling one protester to the ground. Others were hauled away in a nearby van. Activists who I talked to for this story asked me not to use their names because they fear retaliation. Locals here say that municipal and state authorities, who are responsible for the landfill, haven't responded to the health risks. One woman who lives near the landfill says even nearby waterways are polluted. You rarely see fish or frogs here anymore, she says, and lots of people have cancer. She says three people in her family have died of cancer. People all over Russia are speaking out right now to save the environment. Many say they were inspired by activists who recently shut down the construction of a giant new landfill in the far north, where authorities plan to ship millions of tons of garbage from Moscow. Activists camped out at the construction site for months, protesting and singing songs, as captured in this video by the BBC. Large landfills have drawn some of the biggest resistance, but Russians are also taking on big oil. Activists in the Komi Republic, another region in northern Russia, posted a video online of a river there covered in a black oil slick. The region is a key producer of oil and natural gas. Activists say oil constantly leaks from aging pipelines. They blame Lukoil, one of Russia's largest energy companies, for the mess. The company didn't respond to my request for comment about the problem, but concerned citizens have been asking them tough questions. Journalists recently filmed a public hearing where locals berated a representative from the company. Would you want your children to be exposed to toxic chemicals, one woman asks? The company representative says, well, we have to drill oil so the government can fund your kids' schools. I talked with a local activist here who works with an environmental organization that drafted a bill which would require oil companies to replace their pipelines every 15 years to stop oil leaks. It will soon be considered by the federal government, and she's optimistic it will pass.
Экологическая проблема, она объединяет людей абсолютно разных взглядов.
She says the environment is one area where Russians with very different political views can come together and agree, even at a time when Russia is at war and the country is incredibly divided. Other environmental activists who've taken on much smaller causes are also having success. A man who lives in a village outside Moscow sent me a video he filmed last winter of an illegal development project near his home that's on public land. Trudging through the snow, he filmed a clear-cut forest and huge bonfires crackling where loggers burned the wood. The destruction is devastating for locals like this villager, who take walks and go skiing here.
When we saw mass cutting down trees, everybody were outraged, just were angry. The whole purpose of living next to the forest was just to get fresh air from the forest.
But the developer put up fences around the forest, and for a while, even had an armed guard to stop people from entering. They planned to build a spa there. Businessmen in Russia often just pay bribes to authorities to take over public land, but locals documented the violations and approached the regional government.
We thought it was a hopeless case for us, but the more we had shown evidence of how much the forest had been burned, the more they were keen to cooperate with us.
The local forestry committee actually took legal action to stop the project. The villager says protecting the environment sometimes fits into the Russian government's narrative right now of the need to defend a great, heroic country with pristine rivers and forests.
So environmental cases is just part of this patriotic rhetoric, which is widely used by the government.
But this work is still incredibly difficult because it often challenges government and business interests. This year, dozens of environmental activists in Russia have been fined by the courts, often just for holding protests or rallies. Some have even been physically attacked by unidentified thugs. And one activist recently committed suicide, in large part because of the stress the authorities put on him. But the woman I talked to, who's trying to close the landfill in her town, says she's not afraid. She says you can't stay quiet once they try to kill you, and they are killing us with this toxic dump. So we're fighting for our lives. She's been complaining to authorities about the landfill for years with no meaningful response. But recently, federal authorities opened an investigation and recalled rice grown near the landfill. While Russia's government keeps closing environmental organizations like Greenpeace, ordinary citizens are now stepping up and fighting for a greener planet. For the World, I'm Levi Bridges in Shymkent, Kazakhstan.
I'm Carolyn Beeler, and this is The World. Scientists have been warning us all about the impacts of climate change for well over three decades. And for all of that time, there's been a degree of frustration that we just aren't paying enough attention. A new video series out of the UK aims to change that by pairing up climate scientists with comedians.
Hi, I'm Bill Maguire, and I'm Professor Emeritus of Geophysical and Climate Hazards at University College London.
Hi, I'm Kiri Pritchard-McLean, comedian, and I did go to university, but only because I'd run out of people to get off with in my village.
The idea here, to translate science ease into more human language with a dash of humor.
Human-caused climate change is fundamentally changing the fabric of the weather as we know it. It's leading to events which we've simply never seen before.
Translation: weather used to be clouds. Now we've made it into a sort of Rottweiler on steroids that wants to chew everyone's head off.
That's comedian Nish Kumar interpreting the words of Frederica Otto, senior lecturer on climate science at Imperial College London. They're both part of this climate comedy project called Climate Science Translated, and two of the producers are joining us now, Nick Aldridge and Ben Carey. Hello to you both. Thanks for being with us.
Hi there. Hi there. Good to be here.
So let's start with you, Nick. I've noticed in the past decade or so that climate scientists have actually gotten more confident and better at speaking in plain, accessible language about climate change. Why do you think this translation is still necessary?
Well, hi, yeah, no, I think they might have done, but they're still probably speaking to the same group of us who are tuned into the environmental issue. And I think what struck me was it just seemed to be me and this small group really focused on this, getting more and more concerned as more and more time goes by. And then the large majority completely oblivious. I can trace it back to a ski trip I do with some really old college friends when I suggested to them one year, guys, maybe we shouldn't fly to the Alps. Why don't we take the train or the electric car? And they looked at me like I was slightly mad and started calling me Greta. So then I thought, there's a problem here. These guys are not reading what I'm reading. So we need to rectify that some way.
So the idea is to broaden the audience of who is hearing these messages. Ben, why turn to comedians specifically?
Well, I think the idea is, first of all, to use
messages that people want to listen to. You know, no one likes a lecture ultimately, but you know, if you're being told you're going to listen to a comedian, you might enjoy it. So I think that's at one level what we're doing. And then the other important thing I think is it's not just playing it for laughs, is that comedians are allowed to tell it like it is. You know, they can cut all the nonsense and distill stuff to the real kind of truth of the matter in language that, you know, they have more license to say what they want than almost anyone else. So we found that also quite useful for the crisis we're dealing with.
All right, we've got another clip from another of your videos, scientist Bill McGuire and comedian Kiri Pritchard-McLean.
Most of us by now are aware we're facing a climate crisis, but perhaps not the full scale and urgency of it. Over the last 200 years, the global average temperature has risen by roughly 1.3 degrees centigrade, which sounds relatively modest, but is already leading to an explosion of extreme weather events.
Quick translation, half the world is flooded and the other half is a bonfire. And it's still early days.
So what we heard there is obviously, you know, an exaggeration. Half of the world flooded, the other half a bonfire. Ben, scientists are super careful about how they communicate what they know. They're very careful to never get ahead of the data. So how have they felt about having their messages summed up like this in kind of potentially exaggerated punchlines?
Yeah, you would never get a scientist saying that line. And in fact, you know, part of the fun here is that the professor says something very kind of, you know, carefully scientific and in line with the data. And then the comedian just kind of rips it apart and exaggerates it for comic effect. But we did, having said that, we did check what the comedians were saying back with the scientists.
Have they reacted in a way that, you know, this is liberating to be able to hear their messages put in this kind of way?
I think they want to be able to communicate very clearly the urgency of this. But the paradox is if they really go beyond the scientific language too much, they're not credible anymore. So in a way, they need help, which is what the project is about.
I'm speaking with Ben Carey and Nick Oldridge, two of the people behind the climate comedy video series, Climate Science Translated. Nick, attitudes about climate change are changing. They have been changing. Are you noticing that more people are getting it?
They're definitely changing, but I think we're dealing with a numbers game, aren't we? So time is running out for our window for dealing with it. So we need numbers, and we need the numbers of people shouting and using all their agency in whatever part of society they come from. And so that is a public information problem. It's a communication problem. So I was just a regular guy thinking, I can't do much to impact this. But I looked at money that I was planning to leave to my kids and thought, well, this won't exist in the future if we carry on our current path. So I do need to do something. And it was then through a bit of investigation I connected up with Ben and Henry Delahad, Ben's colleague. And this is these two who are the creatives that I teamed up with. This is where the comedy idea came from. But it was all based on me thinking it's shifting, but it's just not shifting fast enough. And we don't have the time to wait now.
Mm. We've got another clip now from comedian Jonathan Pye translating for Joanna Haig, Emeritus Professor of Atmospheric Physics at Imperial College London.
Historically, fossil fuels are responsible for about two-thirds of emissions, but the fossil fuel industry lobbies strongly against cuts. In fact, it's getting governments to grant new licenses for even more exploration, more oil and gas.
When you're in a hole, stop digging. That's the proverb. Not dig even more to maximize profits until the whole planet is doomed and you can go live in your bunker.
I love that one. It puts a very fine point on it. So we're talking climate comedy. Do either of you know any climate change jokes?
No, is the answer. Mm. This is Ben. I mean, I think it's a tricky one, really, because, for example, it'd be very easy to be cynical about the climate. So it's actually quite tricky to find jokes and the right level of humor that not only makes you laugh, but also makes you want to act. That's been the tricky thing to get right.
This is why we brought in the professionals, clearly.
Ben, if you could get any comedian or any scientist to pair up, who would you choose?
Well, I'd love to bring this format to the US, actually, because I think you've got a bunch of brilliant comedians and scientists. I mean, I'm seeing maybe Michael Mann as the scientist and possibly Tina Fey as The Comedian, for example, that could be good.
I would definitely watch that. Ben Carey and Nick Oldridge from the UK-based effort that's teamed up scientists with comedians, Climate Science Translated. You can find it on YouTube, Climate Science Translated. Nick and Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend. Be good to each other, and we'll see you back here on Monday.
Marco here. Before we go, just a reminder that right now The World is holding our fall fundraising drive. Your support is critical. It powers our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting. Our goal is to raise $67,000 before the end of the year. Every gift counts. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much, and be well.
From PRX.